At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All to Sarah. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and definitely not a lawyer. And because I'm not a lawyer, I have asked my friend George Conway from the Society for the Rule of Law to explain this week's legal news to me. And there's a lot to explain because, George, I'm going to ask you to explain 2 Trump trials that are going on right now. The first is the E. Jean Carroll case happening this week, and the second is the Trump Organization fraud case that wrapped last week. And unlike the January 6th cases that we talked about last time, this, like, that was a criminal case, but this is a civil case, right? Which means it's about money right. And not going to jail, correct?
Correct. These are both civil cases, absolutely. But significant civil cases.
I'm getting better at the legal stuff already. Okay.
Yeah.
So I want to start with the E. Jean Carroll case because Trump is big mad at you. He's out there bleeding at you right now on Truth Social. Yeah, he's very mad at you. You've made him upset.
And this makes me very sad.
Yeah,
this
I'm
is
sure
my
you're
sad
really
face.
Torn up about it.
This is my sad face. Okay.
So let me just read you a couple of things. First, a recent filing in this case says that the idea of suing Mr. Trump crystallized in Ms. Carroll's mind as a result of a conversation at a party with George Conway, a Republican lawyer who does not like Mr. Trump, and that Mr. Conway then introduced her to a lawyer. Then today on the stand, when E. Jean Carroll was asked why she decided to sue Trump, she said that at a party, you explained the difference between a civil and criminal case, like you just did with me, and walked her through the steps to sue and said that you would help her get a lawyer. And then, in a bleat on Truth Social today, Trump complained about the unfairness of the trial and wrote, even E. Jean Carroll's lawyer is a Democrat political operative.
And she's a Democrat?
A Democrat.
Democrat? Nobody told
Democrat
me that.
A Democrat political operative. And this whole hoax was funded and conceived of by Reid Hoffman, George Conway, and many others in the Democratic system of thugs. All right, 3 questions.
I'm a Democratic thug.
One, what party was this? Why wasn't I invited? And
it
how does it feel
Republican
to be a Democratic
party.
Thug?
Okay. Well, once upon a time, there was a president. He was a bad man. And he used to sexually harass women.
You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the
One day, a woman wrote a book describing all the bad men in her life. And the book came out and mentioned this president as being one of them. And he had raped her in a department store in New York City. I did not know anything about this until I read it in a magazine, New York Magazine. And it just so happened that I wrote something in the Washington Post a few days later that basically said, hey, if you guys believe Juanita Broderick, then you got to believe this woman, because what happened was, I saw Jean Carroll's original story, and then I saw this interview in the New York Times where it was clear that she had told two other people, almost immediately after it happened. And to me, that's a very, 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 very compelling circumstance when it comes to these Me Too type cases. If the two things that I think are the most compelling, if you follow the work of Ronan Farrow and the recent last few years of stories coming about bad men doing things to women, the two factors that you really have to consider are, did the guy do it to other people? And were there contemporaneous witnesses? Because if something bad happens to you, you're going to want to tell somebody, even if you don't go to the police. And to me, this was a pretty compelling case. And it happened that, you know, I had never met Jean Carroll before. But the following week, within a week or two, I was at a party in New York at Molly John Fast's apartment. And lo and behold, there's E. Jean Carroll. And she came up to me and, you know, she thanked me for the article that I'd written in the Washington Post, which had effectively defended her. It was basically, I was just arguing that, well, Trump made a big deal out of Juanita Broderick during the campaign, he and Bannon. And I think that there was some credibility to Broderick's claim, but it wasn't as strong as Jean Carroll's claim, which is the point of my article. And so Jean thanked me for that. And then she mentioned the fact that, you know, some people were telling her that she should sue and that she was thinking about it, but, you know, she didn't know anything about whether it would make sense or not. And what did I think? She was just, you know, just asking me. And my immediate reaction within a millisecond was, you have a libel claim. Because if this happened, and I don't have any reason to disbelieve you, and in fact, the evidence seems to support it based on what I've been reading in the paper, and then there was Trump lying about never having met her when in fact there was a photograph published in New York Magazine of the two of them together with other people. I mean, it struck me that he's lying, she's telling the truth, and she has a libel claim, even if you couldn't bring a lawsuit for something, a physical assault that happened 2.5 decades before. So I told her, and I know precisely the lawyer to bring the case. And it was my friend Robbie Kaplan, who I'd gotten to know over the prior year or two. She is just a fantastic lawyer. She later tried the Charlottesville case, but the thing that she'll always be remembered for is she won on behalf of Edie Windsor, the challenge to the Defense of Marriage Act, a very historic case. And she won that case. And she's also just a terrific trial lawyer and a great person. And she's also bringing another lawsuit against Trump for the pyramid scheme that he was running on The Apprentice. And that case is scheduled to go to trial in a few weeks. But anyway, I told Jean Carroll, I think I know the right lawyer for you. And the next day I got in touch with Robbie Kaplan, and then she met with Jean, and Jean retained her, and the rest is history. She got this great verdict during the first trial. He now is, and you know, there was, what happened was, she brought suit for the libel that he libeled her and defamed her by calling her a liar when he was president. And Jean testified about what happened to her in the department store, and her friends testified about what she said happened to them back in the 1990s when this happened. And then there were a couple of other witnesses who testified basically that Donald Trump tried to do the exact same thing to them. Natasha Stoyanov, who was a reporter at People magazine, testified that she was assigned to do a feature story on Trump, and Trump cornered her in the Mar-a-Lago ballroom and tried to sexually assault her. And she was saved by some guy who said, "Oh, Mr. Trump, Melania's coming." And then there was a woman who was he molested on an airplane, of all places. But anyway, the jury came back with a $5 million verdict in last summer in favor of Jean Carroll, $2 million for the rape and $3 million for the defamation. And as a result, the judge has ruled that basically that first verdict means that the only issue in this trial is damages. So this case is only about damages. And that is what's going on right now before Judge Kaplan in the Southern District of New York, a trial that's only about damages.
Oh, Why do you think he's so fixated on you in this? Like, why are you winding up in the testimony? Who cares if he got his lawyer? That doesn't seem germane.
Because he's a narcissistic sociopath. Narcissists are obsessed with getting revenge. They feel persecuted. I mean, they feel like they should be able to do whatever they want. But when somebody says, no, you can't do that, like, you can't rape people, they get mad. When they're told, no, you can't just stand up in court and just yammer stuff. You have to answer questions and be sworn. They get mad. And they're always seeking to blame somebody else for their conduct. And so I'm a very convenient target. Happy to be the target because I think I did something pretty good when I found Jean her lawyer. But he wants to deflect attention from himself. He wants to avoid responsibility for his own actions, and he's always seeking vengeance. So there, you know, and he's also seeking to distract from his own conduct by alleging a massive conspiracy, which of course makes no sense. And, you know, actually I would have a libel claim against him if I chose to bring one for alleging that I perpetrated a hoax, which makes absolutely no sense since I didn't know anything about Jean Carroll or what had happened to her. Until after it became public. And so therefore it's hard to imagine that this was some kind of a put up job. I mean, her story was baked in the cake years ago. She told what happened to people decades ago before I even knew who Jean Carroll was. But nonetheless, I'm a Democrat thug and yada, yada, yada. You know how it is.
Do you have any response? What do you do when he does these things? It's probably less bad now than when it was Twitter, because so many fewer
people.
I
take it as a badge of honor, and I mock it, which is what everyone should do. Everyone needs to mock Donald Trump because he is so mockable, and it's just he has to be taken seriously because he's a danger to the republic, but you can't ever lose sight of the fact that he's a complete buffoon, and we have to keep saying that the two are completely consistent. He's a dangerous buffoon. And it's funny because I think his own people, people that I know who have worked with him or for him, they don't take him quite that seriously because they think he's a buffoon. So they kind of make fun of us for saying, why are you so obsessed with him? Why do you think he's so dangerous? Because they know he's a buffoon. But the fact of the matter is, he's a dangerous buffoon. And for reasons that, you know, you and I could go on for days about.
Yeah, you know, Charlie Sykes always says a clown with a flamethrower still has a flamethrower.
Correct.
So, yeah.
Yes.
I always think that's a nice way to talk about
that. That's
this.
A nice one. Right. Right.
Yeah. Okay. So moving on from Trump's, you know, big emotions, big picture, can you explain? So you talked about how this is about damages, but like, what's going to happen? What's next?
Okay. What's going to happen is, I mean, Jean Carroll testified on direct examination. Her lawyer, Robbie Kaplan, took her through what happened to her. I haven't seen a transcript. I saw some live tweeting of it. And basically, I mean, her story is the one actually she told at the first trial, which is Trump lied about her. And this is, there's no, you know, the jury is being instructed that Trump lied. This is a fact. Trump cannot contest it in this trial. And the jury has to take it as a given. And she explained the consequences of that lie to her emotionally, to her needing security, which is a big thing, and her career, and all the different negative things that happened to her as the result of Trump telling this persistent lie, and how Trump continues to tell the lie even after a jury found that he had lied. And in fact, he has been tweeting or Xing or whatever you want to call it incessantly, more lies about her, that he never met her, that she's a liar, and that it's a put up job, like that's going to go to punitive damages, because if somebody doesn't get the message, that's the poor purpose of punitive damages, to punish bad behavior from people who not only just violated somebody's rights, but didn't give a shit about violating someone's rights. Oh, you're going to bleep that. I'm sorry.
Well, that's up to Barry. He'll decide.
That's up to Barry. Okay.
Okay.
This is a podcast.
Right? Okay, so I guess now that we've talked about E. Jean Carroll, I do want to move on to the what was the original topic, which is the Trump Organization fraud trial. There's so much legal news. There's so much. This just wrapped up last week. And just like the judge today, that judge told Trump's lawyer to control his client.
Right.
And right, because Trump's always doing that like presidential level headed vibe stuff. That's just like how he behaves.
Obeying the rules like he always does.
Yeah, very normal, very cool.
Showing respect for authority. Absolutely.
Right. That's right. Yeah. And so can you just lay this one out? So starting, like, what's an issue in the fraud case?
All right. What's at issue in the fraud case is basically the books, the records that have been kept by the Trump Organization and its myriad subsidiaries and related entities for many years. And essentially the DA's case, not the DA, but the AG's case is this. Those books were all cooked. They were cooked in any number of ways, but mostly they were cooked in terms of values ascribed to his various assets. And those were used, those financial statements and balance sheets were used to induce banks into lending money and to give to insurance companies. And the problem that Trump has is that the numbers are just not supportable. The numbers in his books were just not supportable to the point where his own accountants disclaimed the numbers and then later quit as his accountants. And his only defense is, well, the banks were going to lend me the money anyway. Nobody actually relied on this stuff. But the problem for that, for Trump, is that under New York law, none of that doesn't necessarily matter. It could matter if somebody were seeking damages on behalf of a bank or something, or somebody who purchased securities. But it's essentially in New York. If you're going to do business in New York, either as a New York corporation or as a non-New York corporation that is authorized to do business in New York, you're obliged to keep accurate books and records. And if you do not, you can forfeit the right to do business. The judge essentially has already found that the books were cooked, and it's just a question of his intent to do that. And it's pretty clear the judge is, you know, what was issue at the trial, even though the judge had found on the basis of documentary evidence and granted summary judgment for the trial on the question of falsity, the issues here were, you know, his state of mind in participating in the making of those false statements in the books. And again, which is not something that has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, because this is a civil case. It only has to be proven to basically 50.01%, more likely than not, that he, you know, intended to put false statements in the books. And there's going to be little question about that. And then the other issue would be how much restitution, how much is the state entitled to recover from him, in terms of ill-gotten gains. Because he was able to keep his business running with these false books for so long. So he's going to lose that case. The question is how much money he's going to have to pay. And that's not good for him.
Okay. So it's money, but like, is there anything else at stake for his family? Like, what kind of penalty are we potentially talking about?
Well, we're talking, I mean, I don't remember the precise amount that the attorney general is seeking, but it is $200 or $300 million or more. It's a lot of money.
That's real money.
It's
different.
It is real money. And I have no sense of how much liquidity he has, but it's going to be a bad thing for him if he has to pay that judgment.
What are the chances he does?
I think the chances are reasonably high, but we'll see. I mean, this judge is going to rule fairly quickly. I think it's going to be a substantial number. He didn't seem to show much sympathy for Trump's arguments or his antics. And we'll see.
Okay. So I want to read some quotes from Trump on the last day of his trial. So he said, "This was a political witch hunt. We should receive damages for what this company has gone through. And also, this is election interference." I'm playing all the hits here. The person here, meaning the New York Attorney General, hates Trump and doesn't want Trump to win elections. excellent use of first third person Trump there.
Yeah.
He also directed a comment at the judge and said, "You have your own agenda. You can't listen for more than 1 minute." Now, again, not a legal scholar over here, but this seems like atypical courtroom behavior for a defendant in a serious lawsuit.
Right.
What happens when you just act like a lunatic like this, yelling at the judge?
You don't get much. You don't get much credence from the judge. I don't think a judge is going to change his conclusions because of this. A good judge will not do that. A good judge will not get resentful and seek vengeance in his judgment. But the truth of the matter is, if that's what you're doing, it reeks of weakness. And if you the way to appeal to a judge is to show them you have some facts and that you have some law, and he's not doing that because he's not capable of doing that. And that's not good for him. And that's not good for, it's not going to be good on appeal. It's not going to be, he's created a terrible, terrible record for himself. And at this point in the other case, in the Jean Carroll case, I mean, he's got this lawyer who basically doesn't even know how to try a case. I mean, she was basically getting schooled by the judge today on how to do things like mark an exhibit, move an exhibit into evidence, cross-examine a witness based upon a deposition transcript. I mean, things that law students and sometimes mock trial participants in high school learn how to do. And, this woman, Alina Haba, did not know how to do that.
Yo, can we talk about this Haba attorney for just 1 second?
Haba, yes. Haba, nice day. Haba.
Why would he choose? She has done, I have seen her make all kinds of comments that she shouldn't be making in public, on TV, as this counsel. Like, why did he choose her?
Because she plays to him, right? He wants his idea of, he's not capable of reasoned thinking or reasoned argument. He is a narcissistic sociopath, a psychopath, not a rational man. And the law is generally, it tries to be, a rational process. And so he's fighting it every bit of the way because it involves evidence. It involves rules. He doesn't like evidence because doesn't conform to his delusions or fantasies or desires to have people believe false things. And he doesn't believe in rules or laws unless they're applied to other people and unless he's making the rules and laws up as he goes along. So that's, he's always been in a continual battle against the legal system, and this is just part of it. And it's not going well for him, and it will continue not to go well for him.
So let me float a theory at you, which is,
yes,
so Trump's obviously going to appeal this case, right, against the Trump Organization. And the way that he's talking to the judge, to me, reads like he's trying to delay whatever the impact is, and he needs to win the election, right? Like, he's basically, and so what he wants to convey coming out of these court cases is the, like, I'm the tough guy, none of these judges are getting to me, also I'm the victim. And so to me, it seems like a political play.
It's an instinctive play, in part, because he's a narcissistic sociopath. But it is also a political play because that is how he's made it in politics. That the lying and the playing victim appeals to a significant, as we've learned, a significant number of people who, for their own psychological reasons. And so I don't think it's part of. I hesitate to say that it's part of some kind of master plan because, as a sociopath, he's not capable of extensive planning. He's more reactive. He's more instinctive. He's got a kind of like a reptilian brain. Except the reptiles are generally smarter, and he's just doing what he naturally does. It fits in to his political approach, which is basically to play the victim. But that's what he does. I mean, he'd be doing this even if he weren't running for public office, he'd be playing the victim because that's what narcissists do.
I mean, one of the things that's crazy to me is that if the Trump org was found to be cooking the books, right? Like, this is part of his political, like, lore. The lore of him is that he's a great businessman and that he's super rich. And right. part of what this case shows, right, is that he's inflating his wealth all over the place, right? And so, but what never fails,
which actually isn't new, because you know, it came out years ago that he basically was lying to the Forbes to get on the Forbes 400, and you know, there was this lawsuit that he brought against Tim O'Brien that he had to settle because you know, he claimed that Tim had libeled him by saying he wasn't as rich as he made himself out to be. Well, they, you know, turned out that he couldn't sustain that claim. He had to drop the case. So, I mean, this is not new, and it's not, you know, it's consistent with everything we know about the man, is that he exaggerates. He self-promotes. He lies about everything about himself, even when it's not necessary to, he lies. It's pathological.
Yeah, I just, in a different world, the idea that he had made his political brand around being rich, and then there being a case in which he was convicted for cooking the books at his company, that would have an enormous, like, earthquake of political consequence, because it would, like, topple down, like, the whole thing had been a sham. I don't think this will change anything.
No, I don't think it will at all, because I think we've, you know, 7 years in, we've reached this point of what psychologists call malignant normality, and where people just sort of accept the bizarre as, and even people who don't like Trump accept the bizarre as just perfectly normal. And so none of this is going to be, I mean, the people who support him are just going to disbelieve it no matter what the evidence shows, no matter what the findings are. And then the people who oppose him all say, well, we already knew that. And in that sense, you know, he benefits because he's so crazy. He's so mind-bogglingly disturbed that none of this is news anymore.
Yeah. Hey, the results of this are going to be decided by that judge, though, the one he's yelling at, right?
No. Correct. Jury. Yes. Yep.
This guy.
Because apparently, Alina Haba forgot to ask for a jury. I think.
Oh, that's right. This is this case. You know, part of it is, even, you know, so I'm obviously, I don't always understand the ins and outs of the legal side, but I follow it pretty closely. And I forget which things attach to which case. Like, when we were talking about E. Jean Carroll, I was like, right, this is the one where there's the video of Trump when he's getting interviewed and he says, you know, he's like, yes, when you're a star, you're allowed to, it's like,
right.
What he
that's
said.
The, right. No, that was admitted into evidence, both at the first trial and the second trial, that when you're, you know, the Access Hollywood tape, because it goes to his state of mind and so on and so forth.
But it wasn't even the Access Hollywood tape. It was like him, he was saying,
yes. And his deposition.
In this video, I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet, just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything. Grab them by the you can do anything. That's what you said, correct?
Well, historically, that's true with stars.
It's true with stars that they can grab women by the
Well, that's what, that's, if you look over the last million years, I guess that's been largely true. Not always, but largely true. Unfortunately or fortunately.
And you consider yourself to be a star?
I think you can say that, yeah.
Right. Time they have let great men do whatever they want. You know, fortunately, I was like, and unfortunately that was, or fortunately.
Yes. Right. I mean, that's right. That was at his deposition. That was at his deposition in the Jean Carroll case. Robbie Kaplan basically showed him, or quoted at him the Access Hollywood tape and asked him, "Hey, is this true?" And he basically said, "Yeah." And that's consistent with his narcissistic, sociopathic way of looking at the world. It's why he says he likes to talk about how Kim Jong-un wants to see him. He said this the other day. Kim Jong-un wants to see him president again. I mean, it's the same kind of sickness.
What an endorsement.
That pervades. A great
murderous dictator wants to be
A murderous dictator, right. And, you know, it's consistent with Trump the other day saying that, you know, Sammy the Bull Gravano had it right, that Trump is, you know, a great man and these judges better watch out or something like that. I mean, something.
Who's that?
Absolutely.
Who's that person you're talking about?
What? Sammy the Bull Gravano, a mobster?
Yeah, who's
famous
that?
Mobster? Famous mobster who was apparently giving an interview saying nice things about Donald Trump. And so Donald Trump said, this is great.
I mean,
I'm not making this up. You can't make this
that
up.
That must come
right?
from a place where, like, if nobody's ever liked you, you'll take a compliment wherever you can get it, even if it's
no,
like...
No, it's not. It's worse than that. He likes people. He likes that type. He likes criminal dictators. He likes mobsters. Okay? He admires them. He thought the best lawyer in the world was Roy Cohn, who was the most unethical lawyer, one of the most unethical lawyers in American history. You know, I don't know what else. He admires people who are fellow sociopaths. That's just basically how he rolls.
Well, I, for one, I know that what's that expression? The wheels of justice turn slow, but they turn fine.
Yes. They grind slowly, but they grind fine. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's basically what's happening to him.
That is what's happening, right? They got.
But he is. But he has tools. You right. He's absolutely trying to run out the clock. I mean, that's part of what he's doing. He is trying to run out the clock on all of this stuff because he has figured out, I'm sure people have told him, that if he becomes president, I can not at the civil cases, he can't. It won't help him. But basically, if he were in jail at noon on January 20th, 2025, having been convicted of something or other this year, and he gets 270 electoral votes, well, they're going to have to spring him, I think, under the Constitution, which wouldn't be great. But, you know, that's his best play, and that's what he's trying to do, among others.
Hey, what did you think? So this was something interesting that just came out of Iowa with the one of the things that was in the exit polls or entrance polls, and those are not terribly reliable, but it was something like 31% of the primary voters said that they would not vote for him if he was convicted of a crime. Do you believe that?
I believe that there are. Here's my theory, and I don't know why I'm telling you this, because you're the one who actually conducts focus groups and talks to voters, unlike I. I do not. But I do think there are going to be, broadly speaking, they're going to be people who are never going to believe anything bad that's said about Donald Trump, even if they're shown video of it. They will say it's a deep fake or something. And then there are people who don't like the Democrats, want to vote for a Republican, and but are exhausted by Trump and embarrassed by Trump. And I do think that those people can be moved more so than in 2020, because I just think it's incumbent upon all of us to really, really hammer at him in a way I don't think happened even in 2020. I think 2020, it was sort of easier because he was president. I think now his big advantage is that he's been off everyone's radar screens. This deplatforming
100%.
Of him. Deplatforming of him has made him more of an abstraction. Like, you forget how bad he is, and then you worry about things, you know, you worry about things that are not really as significant as having a sociopath in charge of the second largest nuclear arsenal on the planet. So that's going to be the important thing is for us, every single one of us, including people who are listening, you know, you've got to engage people and tell them what you think and tell them why this is bad. And I think there's another potential effect. And again, this I defer to you. Maybe this is fantasy on my part, but I do think that the more this happens, the more it demoralizes even the fanatics. And my one data point on this, well, I mean, the one data point is turnout, although that could have been due to the weather in Iowa, but there was also an interesting report that was leaked. It was a report prepared by Club for Growth. You may have read it or seen it, but they had focus group tested a bunch of negative ads about Trump. And they found two things. The first thing was it didn't affect people's willingness to say they were going to vote for Trump. They basically showed all the bad things about Trump. And people said, well, I still support him. But they found that it dampened their enthusiasm. And I think the people who support him are exhausted too. And I think at the end of the day, what we're going to see, assuming, you know, nothing bad happens to Joe Biden, and the Democrats do what they should be doing, and God knows they have the money to do it, the turnout is going to be huge for people who don't want to see Trump again, and it's not going to be so great for the people who are just trying to stick by him, because deep down a lot of them know better, and also they're just exhausted. And that's why I think at the end of the day, I'm hopeful that we will not all end up in Guantanamo.
Yeah, I want to underscore something you said there. I was just talking about this with a reporter, and it is this idea of, right now, Joe Biden is front and center for people. I hear this in the
Congress
all the time, right? So they know what they're annoyed about with Joe Biden. They're frustrated with the economy. I heard this in 2022 from swing voters going into the election as well. They were mad about Joe Biden, whatever. But then when you said, okay, well, then who are you going to vote for, Blake Masters or Mark Kelly? They were like, I'm not going to vote for that psychopath, Blake Masters. He's crazy on abortion. He thinks the election was stolen and he likes the Unabomber. Like, I'm not going to vote for him. And I think I think we're at a low watermark for Joe Biden and a high watermark for Trump, because he's about to sort of get a coronation nomination. But then I think once that contrast becomes clear, because something else that's clear in the groups is that people don't know yet that it's Biden versus Trump. They just have not grasped it.
They don't believe it.
They
haven't focused it. Yeah. And I still second that to you, and I'll use even bigger data points. In 2016, Hillary was ahead until Hillary became the issue. And one of the things that happened when they, you know, got rid of Manafort and put in my ex-wife and so on in the fall was they started making the campaign about Hillary. And that's why she lost. In 2020, he lost because the election was about him. He was the incumbent. In 2024, it's going to become about him again, even though he's not the incumbent, because all of us are going to make it about him, and he can't help but make it about himself.
I think that's 100% right. And I think that also underscore your part about we're all going to have to do this job. It's one of the reasons we need to make sure people understand what's happening in these court cases. And so, George, then I appreciate you. Another week of George Conway Explains It All to Sarah. I feel like we're all getting a lot out of this. It was great to talk to you. And we're going to come back and do this again next
week. Absolutely. All right. Because Lord knows there will be something next week as well.
There will be. All right. Thanks so much.
Bye.